had to go down and get my cheat sheet, but our next guest, you know, we could do it without an introduction anyway, is Jeremy Ruck's going to talk on engineering microwave links. And Jeremy is the principal engineer of Jeremy Ruck and Associates. He's got 30 years in broadcasting experience, 25 years in RF consulting. Jeremy holds a double E from Bradley University. He's also a professionally licensed engineer, a PE. And I enjoy his contributions to radio magazines. So, Jeremy, I'm looking forward to your presentation as always.
Thanks, Gary.
Yep.
All right. Guys are a little late on the applause here today. It's good to see everybody. I got I'm double wired here. Kirk's going to record me today, and then I've got the mic for the WBA thing as well. Tough act to follow. If isn't this a great show? I mean, I know a lot of you guys have probably been to NAB. NAB's just big. It's got nothing on this show. This is the best show. And if you haven't said anything to Linda and the committee before you leave, please make sure you do so, because this is one of the highlights of the year, I think, coming up here. So with that in mind, you guys know how we start this off. We got a couple things to show you before we get started here. As you guys know, we always got to throw a political joke in because we're getting close to the election here. And we've got the proverbial sanitation truck here, which is full of the political promises. It's kind of a dumpster fire this year, I think, isn't it? Saw this in a local grocery store. Now, there's a couple of ways we can interpret this. I don't know if this is for our college students, if it's the parents, or maybe it's for the teachers. Life on the road as an engineer, you see a lot of interesting stuff. So a good thing there wasn't a fire. And then, as I alluded to, we got a good show here. And I think everything north of the border up here is really kind of nice. We get down into the tropics in Illinois. As you guys know, we do things a lot differently. Those of us that are unlucky enough to live in the People's Republic kind of know that. We have a little different perspective on things, too. So this is something I saw on the way up. So if you squint real hard, you might see the engine. So, all right, we're going to talk about microwave transmission networks today. I'm going to do a shameless plug here. For those of us that still read books, every now and then a definitive text comes along that kind of is just really, really excellent. Carl Smith's Theory and Design of Directional Antennas. Those of us that know that book will realize that. John Krause's antenna book, Jasek's book. To add to that list is microwave transmission networks. And at the end of the thing, I've got the ISBN number and all that available. If you're interested in this topic, I highly recommend this book. You can get it from the NAB bookstore or SBE bookstore. And if you're a member of either, there is a discount. It's about $100, but it really walks through a lot of the stuff, and it's been kind of updated in the past few years, so it's really an authoritative text. All right, so let's get started. I've got some main topics that we want to talk about. And as usual, I'm going to throw a lot of information at you guys. Hopefully with the cake and the sugar, that's going to keep everybody awake. If not, get the slide deck and read it, and I hope I don't put anybody to sleep. So we want to talk about emission designators. That's kind of a little bit of mystery, and there's a couple of things I want to bring up on that. Path profiles, the Fresnel zone, kind of another mystery. A little bit of propagation, always got to throw that in. Some link budgeting. Reliability, diversity, and we'll wrap it up with coordination and rules. All right, so let's begin with emission designators. And this is a series of 9 characters that you'll see a lot of times. Now, typically in the United States, we only use 7 of them, and this current scheme has been in place since the 90s. Anybody who's a ham radio operator before this, you probably remember some of the old designators. Sideband became J3E, which was like, where did that come from? Anyway, it was an internationally mandated set of characters and had by the ITU. And so in the States here, we don't use the last 2 of them, but the rest of them we do. And so the first 4 are going to describe the bandwidth of your emitted signal. The 5th describes the main carrier type. 6 and 7 are the nature and the type of modulation. And then as we get out into some of the more exotic stuff, we can use the 8th and 9th if you're looking at stuff internationally. So the first 4 are going to be comprised of 3 numbers and a letter. The letter is going to occupy a decimal location, and it describes our bandwidth once again. Now, the simple rules on it is we can't have the leading character be a 0, a K, an M, or a G, and that kind of makes sense if you think about it. And so what we do is we're going to divide up the frequency ranges from our point, you know, 1 basically to 999, and then oddly enough, use H, K, M, and G for it. So here's a couple of examples as how this would work. Now, obviously, on those bottom two, I'm sorry, did you say something? Okay, on the bottom two there, you can see when we get into some rounding issues, sometimes we have to sort of work around that just with the number of characters. But with this set of characters here, we can sort of accurately describe how wide a signal is going to be in terms of its spectrum usage. So then our fifth type gives us the carrier modulation type, and we got 7 main breakdowns here. And what we'll do is, you can scan those real quickly, but then we're going to go into a table here, and you can see how this breaks down. So the 7 are, I've got them sort of bold-faced there, and they range from an unmodulated carrier through composite carriers, sequence of pulse. We've got our typical, you know, amplitude modulated, which would be AM, and covers the various schemes there, angle, which is frequency or phase modulation. And one of the things that's in the rules that's interesting to note is that any place you use frequency modulation, you can also use a phase modulation in terms of the emission designator. So an F or a G, either one of those is permitted. It just depends on how it's stated out. In our 6th and 7th, the 6th is generally a number. We have that X that we can use at the bottom if we have something that's not covered. And then, of course, the last one is a letter, depending on the type of information. So here's some kind of some common ones. Our typical AM broadcast, 6K00A3E. The one at the bottom, note that that's an F9W. Now, if you look at some of the database things that are in the microwave authorizations that were carried over from the old database, kind of the default emission designator is F9W. But what's interesting about F9W is that's actually a digital modulation scheme. So in addition to just having that, you have to tell the commission what type of modulation type, whether you're using like COFDM, QPSK, QAM, and you also have to give a modulation rate. Some of the other analog STLs that were out were actually authorized under the old designators, and they carry an F9. So if you file it that way with the commission, you may get a bounce on it. So this is something to be aware of when you're working with your consultant if you're updating it. Anybody gotten emails from Howard Fine about your licenses being? Yeah, you guys, Rick, you guys probably got a lot, didn't you? Yeah. Howard's a guy out in California, and he's, I think at one time was a coordinator, and I think he's retired, but he's gone through the monumental task of going through the entire database finding errors. God bless him for doing that, because there are tons of them out there, as we know. So the problem is, as we get into some of this, it's not just a simple fix. It requires a full coordination, even though you're just changing things on paper. So if you do get into a situation where you have to worry about that, look into the modulation type. And the ruling that I actually got from the commission, we talked to them about this, and you guys may have gotten this too, is regardless of what it says in the literature from the manufacturer, use what you're actually doing. So if the manufacturer says it's F9, but you know it's really F3E, just standard FM like a mono, use the F3E value. Okay, next topic, path profiles, and obviously doing things nowadays with computers. Computers are a great tool, make things a whole lot easier. We can do things a lot quicker. The old days, we used to have to pick points off of a topo map and draw them on this really nice 4/3 Earth paper, which approximates the curvature of the Earth. Now we can just grab it off a terrain CD. But as we've gone further in time, we get things more accurate. And what I want to show you here was the comparison between two databases. This is the exact same path, the top and the bottom. The top one uses a 30-second terrain database where we're grabbing a point every 30 seconds, and the bottom uses a 30-meter terrain database. Now, you can see the shape is generally accurate or generally close to each other, but what's interesting is that the path is actually obstructed with the 30-meter database. So the point make here is that, you know, database is not totally everything, and depending on your accuracy, you can run into trouble or get out of trouble. And always check the path for accuracy. Google Earth is a very, very good tool for this, and check for obstructions. Here's a sample path here. This is about a 10-mile path. Looks great. No obstructions, right? Well, yeah, it shoots right through Sears Tower. Okay? So a lot of times the obstruction databases or the terrain databases are not going to carry the man-made obstructions. So a survey is actually very, very important to go out and do that. Google Earth works really well, but if there's ever any question, you may actually have to go in the field to do it. Obviously, if you can see the two antennas, then it's probably not that big of an issue. Okay, so as we talk about path profiles, one of the key takeaways to remember is that just because you don't have any obstructions on the direct path doesn't mean you're out of the woods. I guess maybe that's kind of a pun. So we do have to consider our optical line of sight, which is a good starter, but you also need to consider the radial line of sight. And this is where we come into play with the Fresnel zone, which is basically a series of concentric ellipses that are centered on the path itself. And so where this comes from is that anytime you have an electromagnetic wave that passes near an object, it's bent. Those of you into astronomy, we talk about gravity waves. As light goes by a very heavy object, it'll tend to be bent. We see the same thing in radio waves, obviously to a less of a degree than astronomical scales. But it can affect the propagation, and does, and so it's something to be aware of. Obviously, the bottom line there, avoid line of sight issues. You'd never want to design something into a path that is a problem, because then when you take the rest of the variables into account, it only gets that much worse. So what is our Fresnel zone? Well, as I mentioned, they're the concentric ellipses, and they're multiples of half wavelengths of the path difference between the direct path and where it perhaps reflects or grazes off of something. And so through the range of angles, if you think about it, it will form this ellipse shape. And so I gave you one of the many equations we're going to start with here. And so we start with the Fresnel zone, which is the square root here. And the n relates to the number of the Fresnel zone. And then it's wavelength dependent, which means it's frequency dependent. The 2 down at the bottom, that's your maximum radius that you're going to find. And those are in terms of feet or meters. And so that's going to occur at the midpoint of the path. And that's sort of the greatest distance or greatest width that you have to figure in for clearance from obstructions. The higher order ones are also important. Anybody shooting paths across water? Anything like that? Yeah. The second Fresnel zone, especially the even order ones, but the second one particular because of its size, that is can be a killer for giving problems over water, desert, maybe a broad highway, anything where you've got a tangential path and that Fresnel zone actually hits that, you're going to wind up potentially with trouble. And it's going to be sporadic. What we're going to look for, though, the main topic or the main thing to try and do is to make sure that you have 60% clearance of that first Fresnel zone. And most of the software out there, you can assign what we call a 6/10 number to it. And as long as you clear that, you're usually in pretty good shape. But you got to figure for foliage and structures. The tree that maybe doesn't obstruct that today, 5 or 10 years could be a real problem. And if something's right at a margin, you may find yourself in trouble down the road. Okay, so let's get into some of the propagation stuff here. As I mentioned, we've got refraction that does occur. That's a bending of the beam. And we're going to describe that by a quantity we call the index of refraction. That's our K number. And this is highly dependent on humidity, temperature, and pressure. So the atmosphere definitely impacts it. And so the propagation that we're going to see on a path in Wisconsin could be vastly different from something in Florida, and similarly vastly different than Arizona or California. And we can also we come up with this gradient figure here that we plug in, which gives us this Earth radius factor. Now, the standard number that we use is that 4/3 I talked to you about, but that's going to vary depending on the season and the locale. So as the gradient number is giving you the rate of change, and so you can see as that fluctuates, where we're going to sit with the K factor. And in one of the slides down the road here, I'll show you how the K factor changes the propagation. Subrefraction is a situation where the beam basically takes off and heads out into space. That's kind of an odd situation, but it is one half of what creates a tropospheric duct, which we'll talk about. Our normal, just kind of normal superrefraction is where it bends down, and obviously a duct, we get 2 different layers where it's going back and forth. And then there's a special case of the trapping as well. Okay, so here's how we compensate for it, and the application of this factor to the real radius in terms of distance of the Earth is what gives us this number. And so you can see dry mountains is going to be our lowest, so like Arizona, high altitudes is going to be 1.2 or so, but in the summer, and if we get down to the southern coast, we're at 1.6. Now, typically for us, we're going to look at stuff in the Midwest and the Northeast, that range in here, and so even maybe 1.33 is probably a little bit light. Maybe we should use something a little bit in the middle. Point being, if you're laying out a path that's right on the edge, maybe look at both climatic conditions and make sure that there aren't any issues as you move seasonally. So, and I don't know, I hope this comes out pretty well here, but this is a difference between two seasonal changes. So I used our standard radius at top, and I used the lower one at the bottom. And if you notice, this point over here to the left actually incurs into the Fresnel zone at 1.2. So what it does is effectively the Earth's shape is changed. The nice thing about using this is what it allows us to do is draw the ray path as being a straight line. In reality, it's really curved because of the refraction, but using this value and this concept allows us to draw it as a straight line. So in this particular case, we might want to take a look at this a little bit more in depth because we do have an incursion into the zone, and if we're right at the margins, this could give us some issue. Now, this was for a 950 path, so the Fresnel zone is very, very broad. Probably not going to be as big of an issue as if we had a 18 or a, you know, a 23 gig path incurring into it. Okay, in terms of propagation, there's a few things that we want to consider. We got free space. Everybody's sort of familiar with that. We're assuming it's a lossless, isotropic, meaning it's the same everywhere type of media. Also, we're going to assume that it's sort of lossless in terms of there's no extra attenuation. This is a nice construct, and it's a good place to start, but we have to add additional things into it. And so that's where we get our reflection, which is going to be surface-based. We talked about that with the even-numbered Fresnel zones. And what happens when you get a reflection is the signal is going to bounce up. It's kind of like multipath. If it reflects in phase when it arrives at the receiving antenna, it will reinforce the direct signal. If it's out of phase, it's going to reduce it. Diffraction, that's our around objects. Scattering, objects in path that are smaller than a wavelength, air and water, okay? That's our atmosphere, water vapor, clouds, things like that. Subrefraction and super refraction, as we mentioned, the sub is kind of rare, but these three here, the last three, are what get us into the tropospheric duct and allow us to carry things, you know, very long miles, or in the case of you wake up and you're here in a station in Arkansas, getting into your STL some Sunday morning. Okay, on the ducting side, for ducting to typically work, what we're going to be looking at is an incident angle into the duct of about 1 degree. So it's got to be real close, you know, a real sharp angle is not going to work. It's got to be almost directly into the duct to make it work. Typically, the ducts we're going to find are based on aloft air that's warm and dry. It's a temperature inversion, okay? We get those around this time of year. You guys that are hams like I am, we'll probably see some pretty good VHF and UHF band openings here in the next month or so. If they're surface-based, we tend to see them on the leeward side of the land, and what I'm saying there is basically if you're near a body of water, they're going to be on the downwind side. That's where they tend to form. And with these, we can do very, very long distances. The land-based ones typically only extend up to about 600 feet, but then some of the other ones where we've got a big body of water can extend up much higher than that. Okay, on link budget, this is actually the heart of any kind of design that you're going to do. And so what I've got here is just sort of a graph where we can see we've got sort of a theoretical system here where we're going to start with a link. And we've got our transmitter and our system, our two antennas, and then system and receiver. And so what we've got is we start with an output power. We're going to subtract our losses on the transmit side. We're going to count for our antenna gain, which is add back into it. Take out our losses from propagation, which is free space and anything else. Then we figure in our antenna gain on the receive side, any system losses there. And then what we're going to wind up with is a received power level. And the difference between that and the threshold of the receiver is what our fade margin is. I didn't put a slide in here, but one of the things to be very, very careful of, and this is always confusing, is the dBm that we're talking about here is in terms of power that I've got here. A lot of times receivers are going to be specced in terms of dBm, but they really mean dBmV, decibels above a millivolt. So we have to make sure that we apply the right correction factor to that. And since we're across, usually across a 50 ohm load, it's going to be different than what the cable TV guys are using across a 75 ohm load. That DBMV number, you can figure out being about 47 above the DBM received power number. Okay, so here's a little more information about this. You can, if transmitter value actually is in watts, sometimes they're specified, converted into DBM. There's a real kind of a simple example there. Put it into milliwatts, take the base 10 log and multiply it by 10. Every time we add zero, we go up 10. Okay, so our system loss is then going to be basically everything that we've got in between the transmitter or receiver and its respective antenna. So this is going to include your feed line, any splitters, combiners, branchers, anything that might take place in there, figure in connectors. And sometimes you may even want to put in a fudge factor as well. And so basically aggregate, you know, come up with the aggregate value of all this, and this will give you your losses before you hit the antenna. Yeah, obviously, we want to do the same procedure on the other side as well so we get an accurate picture. Our antenna gain, we're going to typically see specified in dBi. The other number you may see is dBd. I, of course, is referenced to isotropic or a point source. dBd is going to be referenced to a half-wave dipole. There's a 2.15 dB difference between the two. So need to just keep that in mind. Usually when we do all these calculations, we're going to do it relative to isotropic, so that's kind of the number we want to look for there. And general rule of thumb is if you got a larger antenna, you got higher gain. Also, that means you got smaller beam width as well. All right, so as we go into our propagation loss, not only do we have the free space loss that we need to look about, but we're also going to have to consider vegetation absorption. We're going to need to look at gas absorption, and we're going to need to look at obstacle losses. Now, at FM for 950 megahertz STLs, we can probably ignore the gas absorption. That tends to only become a problem when we're dealing up around 23 gig and higher, but it can be a factor. So in terms of our free space loss, here's some more of that nasty math. It's the free space loss is always present, and it is dependent on your distance and your frequency. The absolute numbers there, that 4 pi d over the wavelength, that's, think of a spherical wavefront, that's where that comes from. If we do a bunch of plugging and chugging and substitution, then we come up with the bottom two numbers there, which will give you that base value in terms of either miles or kilometers, depending on if you want to be American or European. General rule of thumb, if you increase your ERP by 6 dB, you can kind of double your range. It's kind of a general rule. Okay, so vegetation absorption, obviously we want to avoid that as much as possible. And you got to consider the growth. I mentioned that before, but I want to beat on that a little bit again, especially the TV guys. If you're running a really high frequency, like an 18 or 23 gig, when I first did my first foray into broadcasting, we put in an 18 gig microwave link at a TV studio I worked at, and it was fine for about 2 years, and then it died, and we realized it was a tree across the street. We didn't account for it. So we got the Asplund guys out there with the orange truck, cut it down, and you know, away we went. So there's a calculation I gave you there, which is a foliage loss in dB. This is an early empirical model. And empirical means that basically it was determined based on measurements. So a couple of guys a lot smarter than me went out and did a whole bunch of measurements and said, okay, this is kind of what it looks like, and came up with this equation as an approximation. So it's valid, as I mentioned there, for about 200 meg to 95 gig, and the depth of up to about 400 meters or so. So there's a real quick example there. If you got a 1 gig path, which is a foliage depth of about 3 meters, which is probably about the size of a good-sized tree, you can figure on it cutting your signal down by 3 dB. Okay. Just at 1 gig. Right? If we go higher up, obviously it's going to be significantly worse. There's another one here that's called the Weisberger model, and this yields some slightly different results. This is a little bit more complicated as well. This one, what they found is when they started playing around with it, this works really well for trees that have leaves on them that are dry. So basically kind of like now, like with oak trees, before the leaves come off. And works real well in the temperate latitude forest, so basically the 40s, you know, our area. There are a bunch of other newer models that are based on a lot of statistical stuff, and in the book, it talks about some of those, and some of that's online. If you go to ITU, they have a lot of those models available, and some of them get pretty far out in the weeds. So for some good approximations, I like using these two guys here. Okay, so for gas absorption, if you guys remember back to chemistry, between nitrogen and oxygen, we've got about 99% of the volume of atmosphere, nitrogen being 78%, oxygen being 21. So where nitrogen is absorbed, though, is way outside of microwave frequencies, so we can typically ignore it. So then the next two biggest components, and despite what Al Gore and everybody else says, it's not carbon dioxide, it's actually water vapor. So water vapor and oxygen are the two components that cause us the most headaches at microwave frequencies. We have a water vapor absorption at 23 gig. Anybody that's got a path and experienced rain fade, that's what you got going there. Okay. As we go higher up, oxygen becomes a factor at 60. That's when we start getting up into some of the exotic canopy systems and things like that that are shooting about two or three blocks. And actually, in those guys, that can become a real, real problem because they're running right on the margins anyway. Obviously, the other thing to take away from this is as we do increase in frequency, irrespective of which gas we're considering, we also have an increase in the attenuation. And we can tie that back to our free space model and just the fact that we've got lots of scattering taking place as well. Okay. I didn't mention it in here, but dust can also be a factor as well if you live in a sandstorm type of area. Okay, obstacle losses. Let's touch on this real quick. This is a very kind of a real simple case here because this can be a really, really nasty set of calculations, especially if you got multiple ones. So with the triangle there, I'm showing you a single, basically knife edge situation where we've got a beam going across the top of it. And I just made the math or the triangle simple and make it just basically, you know, two equal legs, two equal triangles there. And what we can find there is it's based kind of on trigonometry. And so the angles at the impact figures into everything. But as we boil that all down with the tangent, we can find that really it becomes a function of the distance and the wavelength. And we approximate it then with these guys down here at the bottom, depending on what our new factor is that we come up with over there. So a quick example on this is let's assume we've got a single tree on a 7-gig path. So guys, TV guys, you probably got a 7-gig path out there, 10 miles long. That's not a crazy length. The distance to the tree is about a mile, and the obstacle height is 30 feet above the center of Fresnel. So what's our diffraction attenuation? So as we walk through the math, you can see we're looking at about a 17.5 dB attenuation just based on the knife edge. So this is not a good situation to obviously be in. Note if we take our height equal to zero, in other words, we're just grazing right at the Fresnel zone. Look at what our predicted loss is just with a single knife edge there. 6 dB at 7 gig. So making sure that Fresnel zone is clear of obstructions is very, 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 very critical. Very critical. Okay, we also have to figure in certain other highly variable losses. We're not necessarily going to add this into our link budget, but we got to consider them, that they may be there. Our ground reflections, multipath fading, we kind of talked about that. Flat fading is just a situation where things just fade all the way across. It's kind of an anomalous propagation type of case, and it affects everything just due to local atmospheric conditions. Rain fading, we talked about that, and then refraction and diffraction fading. All right, so path reliability. Once we get this and we get our fade margin at, how reliable is our path going to be? And so this Wiegand's model was derived in about 1975, I think. And it's primarily used in North America. It's kind of the model du jour here, but there are other ones that you can use. It's also frequency and distance dependent, and it's also dependent on climate and terrain. So that's the base equation for it. And here's how we walk it through. So what we find is we find a probability based on our frequency and a path length, and we factor in a climate and terrain factor. And this is what we talked about earlier about the climate changing the effective radius of the Earth and changing the propagation. So this model actually sort of takes this into account. So it's 4 at a water humid climate, so like the Gulf Coast, to like, you know, 0.25 in the mountains. Now I use the term here composite fade margin, and just because of time, I'm not going to really delve into that, but your composite fade margin is going to be the sum of those other things that we talked about, plus sort of your base phase fade margin. So all these other things that tend to impact your received signal level, you can do a power sum of those and come up with a composite fade margin. But we'll just assume a simple fade margin for this. So what this also allows us to do is figure out an outage time. And obviously an outage time is something we want to, you know, keep a close eye on because it's going to cause us breaks in program material. So the first thing we're going to do to look at this is to calculate our fade duration. And that T in there is actually based on temperature. So you can see the temperature impacts our fade. And then the SES is a Ma-Bell quantity, meaning a severely errored second. So this fade outage time times the probability gives us that SES. And then we can give a reliability percentage. And that 315.576, that's based on the number of seconds in a year. So this would give us a percentage on an annual basis. So here's an example. So let's say we got a 30-mile, 7-gig path. Once again, not maybe totally gross. Average terrain and climate, average annual temperature of 40 degrees, so kind of up here in the upper Midwest. And we got a fade margin of 36 dB. Not too bad, right? So if we look at this, we walk through the math, what we find is our predicted reliability is 99.9976%. Pretty good, right? Not too bad. Well, notice that our severely errored seconds is 762 per year. So the predicted outage of this path would be 762 seconds per year. Now remember, that doesn't all come at one time. It could come at one time, but statistically speaking, it could. But usually it's sort of spread out. Could be minor little pops, things like that. Analog days, not a big deal, recovers quickly. If it's long enough on some of the digital schemes, obviously that can be an issue. But how does Ma-Bell look at this? Well, Ma-Bell standard, what they wanted was to say that we had no more than 6.4 severely errored seconds per mile per year for a less than 250-mile path, or 0.8 for a greater than 250. And their standard, basically, they looked at like 1,600 seconds all the way across the path, irrespective of how long the path was. And so that's where this number comes up. So what that yields is a reliability of 99.9994. Everybody ever heard the term five nines? Yeah, that's where this comes from. This comes from the old Bellcore Ma-Bell. Now notice ours was a little bit less than that, okay? So is ours tolerable? Depends. In the case of Ma-Bell, where they're trying to maintain frames and things like that, it probably wasn't. Ours is nearly 10 minutes, whereas, you know, they're down to only a few seconds. So how can we fix it? Well, we can do the thing that a lot of Americans do. Let's just turn the power up and we'll crank it that way. Or we can come up with maybe something that's a little bit more elegant of a solution. And one of them is diversity. And within diversity, we can do three different types of diversity. There's frequency diversity, space diversity, and angular diversity. Not really going to touch on angular diversity because that's more of a kind of a space type of thing. But here's an example of how space diversity works. What we're going to do is we're going to have one transmit antenna, but we're going to have two receive antennas on the same tower. And maybe these are separated by 30 feet, something like that. Well, when we're talking a 7, 10, you know, 18, 23 gig path, we're talking about hundreds of wavelengths here. And so in terms of that, it's a very, very significant span. And because paths do not propagate identically, even though we're on the same stick, the idea being if one's going bad, the other one's not. And so what we found is that when you do this, you can actually eliminate a lot of these reliability problems and get it up in the case. You've got a path that a single path by itself is maybe four nines. You could be up well into the 5-9 range by doing this. Another technique that can be done is frequency diversity. And in this case, we're also using the same concept that two different paths are going to be different. In this case, we're relying on the frequency differential. And here we're looking at about a 2% separation in frequency, and we can get a gain of about 15 dB, a reduction in fading about 15 dB. That's really, really significant, okay? like the MRC hot standbys, twin streams, things like that. Basically, that's the whole concept of what's taking place here, is to make sure that you have the continuity of operation. Let's touch on coordination. Remember, if we license a facility, it's got to be coordinated. And you can self-coordinate. I'm not going to say that too loudly because that's going to cut into some of my business, and some of the Munreese guys cut into some of their business. I know they do it as well. But the notion that you have to pay somebody, you don't need to do that, but you got to make sure you got everything right, because the commission's very much sticklers about it. The coordination procedures are outlined in those three rule sections. And when you do a coordination, you have to deal with the notification and response. I think everybody's probably received the letters from somebody, here's a path, and 250 miles away, blah, blah, blah. So that's the notification part. And the response is, there's really supposed to be a two-way street on this, okay? How many guys have received a notification that says, this is an expedited coordination, you got to respond, if you don't respond within 15 days, we assume everything's okay? Yeah, that's actually wrong, okay? If you read the rules, if you don't respond within 30 days, it's assumed that you've made a reasonable effort. But it clearly talks about expedited coordination requiring actually a response from the party. So it's really supposed to be incumbent on those guys that say, 15 days, they're supposed to get a response from you one way or the other. And the rules even go so far to say that you can give them a verbal, but it's supposed to be followed up with a written. I don't think a lot of that is done. In my realm, I just tend to do things on a 30-day cycle. It makes it a whole lot cleaner and easier. What I tell my clients is, by the time I chase down everybody and call them, it's 30 days anyway. When you do the coordination and you file, it requires a certification. The commission will kick things out without the certification. And as part of the certification, whoever did the coordination actually has to certify that they followed the procedures and give an itemized listing of who was contacted. There's a 6-month time frame from when the letters go out to when they expire. If you haven't filed your application within 6 months, you gotta resend the letters. It's not it can sit out here forever type of thing. And the last thing, major changes must be coordinated. Now, major changes in the microwave realm is vastly different from in the broadcast realm. 25, 30 years ago, just about everything was a major change for FM and AM. Now it's very, very limited scope of things. The microwave stuff, not so much. And so here's kind of a list of the main major technical changes. So lat lon change of greater than 5 seconds. Now, 5 seconds on either or both, but if you do, like, let's say you change 5 seconds of lat and 5 seconds of longitude, that's still considered a minor change. Once you go over that 5 second, it's major. A lot of older paths probably were done with 15-minute maps if it's not been updated. So even though you've never moved the path, if you're bringing something up to date with the data and it's off by more than 5 seconds, it's considered a major change and is theoretically supposed to be coordinated. Any increase in frequency tolerance, increase in bandwidth. Bandwidth makes sense because obviously as you increase the bandwidth, you're going to occupy more spectrum, could step on somebody else. Emission type, we were talking, I'm trying to remember who I was talking with earlier about that. It was like, well, why? Well, remember that with the emission type, the bandwidth is tied in with that. And then some of the interference predictions also are based on the modulation scheme. So that's why it's thrown in there. Any change in the ERP? Greater than 3 dB, that's plus or minus, or I'm sorry, increase of 3 dB. Transmit antenna height increase of 3 meters, and that's AMSL, not ground. So if you've got an old elevation data that's way off, got to fix that. Beam width makes sense, polarization makes sense. Azimuth changes are greater than 1 degree. A lot of old paths are going to come up with this, especially in 25 and 30 years ago, the paths were defined in terms of a transmit location and then a distance and an azimuth. And if somebody got their trig wrong, the azimuth could be off quite a bit. And as you definitively place both ends, that number can get skewed. And then finally, sort of the catch-all, anything you do over a sequence since the last major change that provides a cumulative major change, that's considered a major change too. Okay, I think that's all I got here. So any comments or questions? Yeah, Rick. Yeah, fog is going to, Get you in a second. The fog can is going to factor in you can figure it in the gas absorption, because what's taking place there is you've got basically a saturated environment where the water content of the atmosphere is very, very heavy. And so what you're going to find is, if we can get back to it, basically where we had that peak around 23 gig, that's where you're going to find a lot of that coming in. There we go. Okay, these graphs right here. So you're going to find a big impact down there at the bottom on 23 gig, and then you'll hit some of the other peaks as well. So that's basically a water vapor or a gas absorption type of thing. All right, let's go to Rick, and we'll go back in the back. Rick.
On your last slide, you had the major change rules there.
What did I miss?
The FCC made a determination maybe close to 4 years ago now, even minor changes need coordination. So the latitude and longitude greater than 5 seconds, let's say if it's a transmit side, the Wireless Bureau is going to want you to do a coordination because of this determination from a group of frequency coordinators got together asking this question. We've seen, you know, some people make minor changes. We want determination on some of these rules because there was some gray areas in a few things. Basically, the reading of it, the final was, let's say if you have a microwave path that's missing data, as long as all the other information within the license, the coordinates, the azimuth, and all the other things are correct, and you're just adding missing data, then that's fine. You don't have to do coordination. But if you're going to have to tweak coordinates by a couple seconds under the major change of 5 seconds, they're not going to let it pass because of this, you know, letter that came out or this determination about 4 years ago from this group of coordinators. Yeah, it's a policy that came out back then. So they're basically saying, if you got missing data, fine, enter it, but the rest of your license better be right because you're certifying that with the commission. So if you're still off by a couple seconds, unfortunately, you do have to do the PCN coordination process.
Well, yeah, because if you're off a couple of seconds and then you come back again and say, hey, you know what, I was off by 3 or 4 seconds before. Well, guess what? I made it 2, and now I made it 4 more, so now we've got 6, so the cumulative mod kicks into effect.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the other issue, too, and you're right on that, I have gotten some through if all you're changing is like 2 seconds or something like that and nothing else. Yeah, they're more on that side, exactly. But the azimuth is the one where everybody gets bit on that. I mean, everybody's getting bit on that. And a lot of that has to do with, if you think about the old PAS, we did a lot of that in NAD 27, and that's actually a discussion for another time. We've talked about the coordinate datums before, guys, but a lot of that stuff was done under NAD 27 and was converted to NAD 83. And so there's some, because, you know, the commission doesn't even do things the same between the bureaus. You know, wireless is NAD 83, mass media is NAD 27. And I think one of my presentations on the DTV engineering, we talked about this. Any of you guys looked at your tower registrations lately? How many of you have coordinates on the lat and the lon that are .0 for the seconds? I'll bet $5 your coordinates aren't right. Because a lot of those were taken as the old integral values and converted over. And that's where a lot of this is coming into play from these old conversions. And once again, back to Howard Fine. God bless him for doing what he's doing, because he's bringing this database. He's doing a lot of work to bring the database up. So, gentlemen in the back.
All right. On a guide tower, 6 gig link, pointing into guy wires, which are, you know, several hundred feet out, because the dish is mounted just above one of the guy attachments. So the guy wires are pretty far out in the path, but we're shooting right through them, or not we are, one of our clients is shooting right through them. What should they expect?
Well, in that particular case, one of the things you can look at is take the beam width of the antenna. And so, how big what size dish are you looking at?
It's
8 foot or something like that?
6-foot dish.
6-foot, okay. So we're talking about like a degree and a half, something like that, beam width. And when we talked that beam width, remember that's a 3 dB beam width, so it's a half power. What you can do is you can create and think of an imaginary conical section with a point basically at your transmit antenna, and then do like a degree and a half angle. And if you're out like, you know, 1,000 feet or something like that, you can see that that's going to be a fairly broad cone at that point. And so although the thickness of a guy wire is probably going to be a significant, it'd be a significant fraction of a wavelength in a 6 gig path, in the overall scheme of things, being that far out, and which is going to obviously be very much far field as well, you could probably model it in terms of this sort of knife edge diffraction, because that's sort of kind of going to be what it is, but it's going to be a pretty small one. So long story short, I would think that you would see a little bit of attenuation. I mean, obviously anything in the path is more problematic than nothing in the path. But is it going to rise to the level of attenuating the signal? Unless you're right at the margin, probably not.
Okay.
Did I answer it for you? Cool. All right, let me get real quickly before I step down. I should have put this up. Here's the details on the book. Harvey's not giving me any kickbacks or anything. I just think it's a good book. And I'm a bookphile, so. All right, guys, thank you very much. Appreciate your time, appreciate your attention, and call me. I can answer any more questions.